What's up, comrades? Welcome to the Left Side of Liberty. And today I have yet another special episode for you guys, because again, I missed a week. Sorry about that. But I'm back again with you this week, obviously. And so let's get to it. There's not really a lot that's like earth shattering that's been happening in the news lately. So like I said, I just wanted to do a special. And that special today is going to be on markets and why they're not inherently bad. So that is the subject of today's special. But before I get into that, because I just wanted to have some fun before we dig into the economic and just political gobbledygook, if you will, I wanted us to have a little fun together first, courtesy of my favorite right-wing propaganda outlet, PragerU. So none of these videos that I'm going to play you, because, you know, this will be a type of double video breakdown. None of these videos, neither of these feature Dennis Prager, but they are on PragerU, so there's still a gold mine of sheer propaganda and discredited right-wing talking points and just corporate defending, fundamentalist religion defending horseshit, you know? So, anyway, let's get to the first one here that I want to play. This is, I think, his name is Neil Ferguson. He's Scottish, and he's a quote-unquote historian. And I actually looked him up on Wikipedia, and he's been called out several times for, like, just wildly inaccurate books, and he even said himself that he's more of a theoretical kind of guy, and more of a, I think they even said, like, hypothetical kind of guy rather than a facts-based guy. So even he said that, according to his Wikipedia page. So it makes perfect sense why PragerU would have him on, because the guy is totally counterfactual and totally discredited, but at the same time, he speaks very confidently and very authoritatively, so that convinces the PragerU audience, most of them, that he's somehow this credible source and this, like, highly, you know, this highly intellectual scholar or whatever. So, anyway, let's listen to Niall Ferguson spew some great propaganda about the lovely, talented, and beautiful Margaret Thatcher. I was actually, real quick, before I start this video, I was watching a video this morning of Margaret Thatcher herself giving her final address to the House of Commons in November of 1990. Right before she left office as prime minister. So she was basically just trolling and grilling the Labour Party, saying, like, "Ew, you guys are all terrible socialists, and I'm such a great capitalist. Look at all I did for my country over these past 11 years since I've been in power, you know? Like, you know, oh, look at all the glorious reduction in inequality." And Labour's like, "Fuck you." You know, it's like, yeah, there's record inequality. So, you know, just shut up and sit down, Maggie, you know. Of course, because British Parliament usually is very, like, civil and decorum based, or at least they try to be. They didn't say it that way. I'm saying it that way. But that was the vibe. It was like, fuck you, you know. So anyway, let's listen to Neil Ferguson. And he's going to tell us, you know, why Thatcher was supposedly this great prime minister who saved Western civilization, blah, 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 blah. and, you know, how she was such a free marketeer, which we'll get to later on after the video, or maybe even during it. I don't know. Anyway, let's let Neil talk, shall we?
If you think the world is a mess now, that just means you weren't around in the 1970s. In Britain, where I grew up, the low point was known as the Winter of Discontent, a line borrowed from Shakespeare's Richard III. The inflation rate in 1975 was 27%. The trains were always late, the payphones were always broken, nothing worked. Worst of all were the recurrent strikes. Strikes by coal miners, strikes by dockers, strikes by printers, strikes by refuse collectors, strikes even by gravediggers. It felt as if there was no way back. And then came Margaret Thatcher. Between May 1979, when she entered 10 Downing Street as Prime Minister, and November 1990, when she stepped down, she changed everything.
Well, that's true.
Born on October the 13th, 1925, she was an improbable savior. Nothing in her middle-class childhood suggested the future ahead of her. A diligent student, she got into Oxford as a chemistry major. She worked for a small plastics company after leaving college, but was rejected for a position at the British chemical giant ICI because, as the personnel report stated, this woman is headstrong, obstinate, and dangerously self-opinionated. She needed all three of those attributes when she entered the world of politics as a Conservative candidate in 1950. After several failures, she finally entered Parliament in 1959. For the next two decades, she steadily worked her way up through the party ranks. As early as 1975, Thatcher had come up with a wonderful line about the opposition Labour Party. They've got the usual socialist disease. They've run out of other people's money.
Haha, okay, now we can stop it right there. Okay, so this is a classic line that right-wingers like Neil Ferguson always cite. Like, ooh, you know, Thatcher said that the problem with socialism is you eventually run out of other people's money. You know? So, I have something to say about that, actually. So, you know, Margaret Thatcher is supposedly this, like, free market, like, fundamentalist, if you will. But, it's funny how, at no point in this video, of course, does Neil Ferguson mention the fact that Thatcher used taxpayer money, British taxpayer money, to bail out the auto industry, bail out the railroad industry, and bail out the banks. You know, like, this is stuff that Thatcher did. So it's funny that her, you know, her quote, her comment here of like, ooh, you know, the problem with socialism is you eventually run out of other people's money. As well, it's funny, you didn't have a problem spending other people's money when it came to bailing out big banks and bailing out the auto industry and bailing out the transit system that was privatized under you, but it went to shit, so you had to bail them out. So it's funny how nowhere in this video did Neil Ferguson bring that up. But again, that's not the point of this video. The point of this video is to convince everybody that Thatcher was this like free market pioneer and this ultra liberal in the like classical sense, like ultra like neoliberal, not dogmatist, because that's a negative thing usually, but a sort of consistent, loyal adherent to neoliberal philosophy. There we go. So that's what this video is designed to paint her as. But in reality, she intervened massively in the British economy. And we're going to get to... Actually, you know what? I'll just talk about it now. There was an article that I read just before recording this episode here. It's from Quartz. And they're a pretty, you know, reputable source, so I trust what they were saying here. They basically said that Thatcher was more like Volcker than Reagan, or and even Reagan, you know, the Reagan comparison is kind of like in the sense that he wasn't really a free market guy, that would be a correct comparison. So they kind of do it, but they do it in a way, they contrast Thatcher with Reagan as like, as if to say like Reagan was a totally free market guy, and he wasn't. But anyway, the point is that Thatcher dramatically raised interest rates to try to control the inflation that was going on with the British pound at the time. So, and you know, that was not a very popular policy, raising interest rates. So, and that's not a very free market thing to do. That's actually highly interventionist. But of course, you know, again, when it comes to programs for regular people, when it comes to healthcare programs in Britain, in the British case, it would be the NHS. When it comes to the NHS, when it comes to whatever their version of Social Security is, when it comes to unemployment benefits and unemployment insurance and all of that, when it comes to all that stuff, oh, you know, cut that off, you know, cut spending for that. You're wasting other people's money. You're spending other people's money. But when it comes to bailing out, I was going to say Wall Street, but bailing out big banks and bailing out privatized railroads and bailing out the auto industry, oh no, that's totally fine. You know, I'm not going to adhere to free market policy when it comes to large corporations, but when it comes to helping the workers, you know, yeah, they're scum, they don't deserve anything, and they're just, you know, benefiting from the government spending other people's money. Yeah. Unbelievable. Anyway, continue, Mr. Ferguson.
This she contrasted memorably with what she called the British inheritance. A man's right to work as he will, to spend what he earns, to own property, to have the state as servant and not as master.
Oh, yeah, yeah, like the, state as servant, not as master, like, crushing labor relations, or crushing labor rights, I'm sorry, and, you know, just an authoritarian crackdown on things like free speech and things like, yeah, yeah, totally, the government is gonna be the servant, not the master, yeah, totally, Margaret, yeah, sure, unbelievable. Oh, I hate the hypocrisy so much. I hate it, man. Oh my God. All right, Neil, continue before I have a heart attack.
This was the essence of Thatcherism, and it was just the tonic that the patient, the British economy, needed.
Wrong.
It's fashionable nowadays to argue that there was no Thatcher miracle in the 1980s.
Because there wasn't.
Not only is that demonstrably false, it misses an essential point. Thatcherism wasn't just about raising productivity or creating jobs. Just as important was the goal of defeating inflation and restoring prosperity to the middle class.
But it objectively didn't. She didn't. She didn't raise the standard of living for the middle class. That's totally false. She didn't do that. And even, you know, the Labour Party. Remember, I was talking about the last speech. The Labour Party was like, "No, you didn't, bitch. You did not." Raise the standard of living for the middle class. You took their money and then used it again to bail out the auto industry and bail out the English banks and bail out the British transit system, or the privatized transit system that used to be nationalized. I think, did they renationalize it? I'm pretty sure they did. But under Thatcher, like I said, they privatized it. And then it didn't work out so well. And then Thatcher listen to the pleas of the private railroad companies and, you know, like, "Oh, can you please bail us out, Prime Minister Thatcher?" And she's like, "Oh, yes." You know, so, let's see, he said, so it did not raise productivity. It didn't, restore prosperity to the middle class. True, she did try to, curb inflation, but she massively hiked interest rates. And also the creating jobs thing, this is a common right-wing/neoliberal talking point. like, ooh, you know, the creation of jobs is so wonderful. It's like, okay, but what are those workers getting paid? That's the real question. You know, you can have zero unemployment and it wouldn't matter because what are those workers being paid? I don't give a shit how many people have jobs. You know, like, I mean, I do, but my point is that it doesn't matter if people are employed or not. And yes, it is better to make something as opposed to making nothing. But again, it doesn't make much of a difference if that something isn't nearly enough for what you need to be able to survive. And in that way, Thatcher was terrible with her austerity measures and, you know, cutting benefits and, again, destroying labor rights. You know, so she didn't do anything to help the middle class. She did everything she could to help her rich buddies. That's what the real Thatcher quote unquote legacy is. You know, like pretending as if you care about poor people and workers, but at the same time doing everything in your power to bail out your rich oligarch buddies that probably donated heavily to her campaign to become prime minister, so, and get reelected over and over again. So, this is so irritating. So, again, he's right on like one point out of the four or five that he listed there. Anyway, continue.
Yes, it emphatically achieved. Yet the event that more than any other defined Margaret Thatcher's premiership was not economic, but military. The Falklands War against Argentina established her irrevocably in the public mind as the New Britannia, a warrior queen who gloried in victory. And of course, it ensured a conservative win in the 1983 election. There's no question that sending the Royal Navy Task Force to the South Atlantic took great political courage. Many in her own party pushed for a negotiated settlement. But the lady was not for turning, not because she was nostalgic for the days of empire, but because the invasion was, to her mind, morally and legally wrong.
Okay. So, basically, Neil Ferguson is defending the Falklands War, which actually was the subject, believe it or not, of a Pink Floyd album. Now, I'm a big music guy, so, and Pink Floyd is one of, if not my favorite, band. So, the thing with that album, it was called The Final Cut, and it was the last album that Pink Floyd did with Roger Waters, who was their bass player, occasional lead singer, and primary songwriter, especially following the album Metal into Dark Side of the Moon. So from Dark Side of the Moon onward, he was the primary songwriter in the band. So, but anyway, that's irrelevant. This is not a music podcast. This is a news and politics and economics podcast. So anyway, in 1983, Pink Floyd put out an album called The Final Cut, which, again, was the last album with Roger Waters. And the whole point of the album, the concept that sort of ties the album together, like all the songs in the album together, is that Roger was so angry with Margaret Thatcher for the Falklands War, because the Falklands War is a great example of, see, me being a political science major, there's this political science term. Sorry about that. There's this political science term called the rally around the flag strategy. And the rally around the flag strategy is you manufacture a crisis, basically, and you use that as a pretext to do a military intervention abroad, which usually sends your approval rating through the roof, and oftentimes, like it did with Thatcher, guarantees, as Neil Ferguson even admitted, she did that. That really helped her in winning the 1983 election and being reelected as prime minister. So, now to be fair, I'm not an expert on the Falklands War, but I mean, I know the basics of the Falklands War. So, the Falklands War was a dispute between Argentina and Britain over the territorial sovereignty of the Falkland Islands off the coast of Argentina. So, Argentina said, basically, that the Falklands belonged to us, but because Britain had some, I think there were British citizens living in the Falklands at the time, and so the British elements, Britain used that fact to say, no, we have sovereignty, and we have a claim over these islands. So, they were descendants of British settlers. There are some descendants of British settlers. So, I can guarantee you, though, that this is... that this was a rally around the flag situation where Thatcher used this crisis to go to war. Now, to be clear, no side technically declared war, but there was an intervention. So I should rephrase that to be accurate. She authorized this intervention in order to boost her approval rating and guarantee her a victory in the next election, because military victories help whoever's in power, whoever's the head of state, tremendously. Military victories are almost foolproof ways to guarantee like a shoe-in election victory. So, Falklands War, again, not an expert, but I do know some of the basic history behind it, and I certainly would have been on the side of the people that said, well, why the hell should we get involved in that region anyway? You know, just let's just stay out of it, you know? So, anyway, Neil, let's finish up with your video.
Not without reason did a Soviet magazine nickname Thatcher the Iron Lady. Along with her ideological soulmate, U.S. President Ronald Reagan, she was unhesitating in her opposition to the Soviet Union. When the Soviets deployed intermediate-range nuclear missiles in Eastern Europe, she fully supported, despite fierce opposition, Reagan's countermove to send American cruise and Pershing missiles to Western Europe. It's still terribly hard for...
Sorry, I didn't have the mic very close to the... I didn't have put my phone very close to the mic for the first part of that. So let's replay that. I'm sorry about that.
See, pushed for a negotiated settlement. But the lady was not for turning. Not because she was nostalgic for the days of empire.
Bullshit.
But because the invasion was, to her mind, morally and legally wrong. Not without reason did a Soviet magazine nickname Thatcher the Iron Lady. Along with her ideological soulmate, U.S. President Ronald Reagan, she was unhesitating in her opposition to the Soviet Union. When the Soviets deployed intermediate-range nuclear missiles in Eastern Europe, she fully supported, despite fierce opposition, Reagan's countermove to send American cruise and Pershing missiles to Western Europe. It's still terribly hard for those who opposed her to admit it, but Margaret Thatcher was right about most things.
So here's a tip for you guys. First of all, I'm not going to address the whole Soviet Union thing, because we've been over it 100 times, how, you know, the Soviet Union was not an actual threat to the United States specifically. But also, I doubt very highly that the Soviets would have been stupid enough to mess with the British, because, again, they know, or they knew that we would, to steal a phrase from our president, that the Soviet Union would be met with fire and fury if they even laid a fingernail on Britain, or, you know, or especially the United States. So anyway, let's finish the video here. Before that, Neil, she was not right about most things. So here's a good tip. Whatever Neil Ferguson or the vast majority of the people on PragerU say, so let me repeat that again. The vast, vast majority of what these people on PragerU say, it's you can guarantee, I guarantee you, that 99.99999% of the time, it's the exact opposite. So whatever they say, believe the exact opposite, and you are overwhelmingly likely to get closer to the truth than listening to these liars. You know, that's basically what they are. I was going to say idiots, but I think a lot of these guys are not idiots. They're paid off shills for corporations and the military-industrial complex and Wall Street. It's just, oh, so irritating. Right-wing think tanks, that's another one. Like Neil Ferguson. He even says at the end that he's part of the Hoover Institution. So let's let him finish up here. And then I have a whole other video for you.
She was right that the British trade unions had become much too powerful.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Oh, I knew this was coming. I actually had forgotten it, but now I remember the trade union thing. Yeah, of course. Yeah. Again, total disdain for workers. Total disdain and disregard for the rights of workers under the Thatcher administration. Like, look at how he framed it. Like, ooh, the unions had become much too powerful. You know, it's like, yes, it's the union's fault that the working conditions were so bad. It's not the government's fault, not Thatcher's fault. No, it's the trade unions that were the problem. It's like, give me a break. Now, again, I'm not a big fan of unions. I would rather have flawed unions, which they are. Most unions around the world are very, very flawed, some more than others. But I would rather have flawed unions than no unions at all, at least until, you know, we have a revolution and then we can get worker cooperatives implemented. So, but anyway, yeah, of course, classic PragerU strategy. As you're pretending to care about the middle class and the working class, as you pretend to care about that, just take a dump on the people who are designed to help the situation of workers, and you guys have it because it's in your best interest to do so. You guys are convinced, have been very successful, I mean, at convincing the workers who don't know any better, the like far right conservative workers that don't know any better. You've done a great job at convincing them that the people who are in play, who are put in place, more often than not, to help the position of workers, are the ones that are actually hurting them. Classic right-wing move. Anyway, continue. Of course, it's going to buffer.
She was right that inefficient, nationalized industries had to be privatized.
Ha ha! Ha ha! Oh my god. Yes, yes, that, which is why, again, which is why she bailed out the privatized railroad industry with taxpayer money. That, yeah, so that's, you know, totally, she was a total champion of privatization, which, okay, technically she was, but then once she privatized these systems, she had to bail them out. So I guess that's not exactly textbook definition of privatization and just, you know, letting the market run its course and blah, 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 blah. So he's like half right and half wrong there.
And she was right that the West could win the Cold War. I can't bear Britain in decline, she told a BBC interviewer in April 1979.
What? That's amazing. You know what that means? You know what that means? That doesn't mean what Neil Ferguson wants you to think it means. What he's trying to say that means is, and I'm assuming what Thatcher wanted it to sound like she meant, was I don't want to see the mass, the majority of British citizens, I don't want to see them suffer, basically. I don't want to see them go through economic hardship. But what, here's the reality of what she meant. What she meant by Britain in decline is the rich people in decline. That's what she means. Rich Britain in decline. She didn't want to see that. Again, she didn't give a shit if the workers were in decline. She just gave a shit if the rich people, the capitalist class, was in decline or not. So, anyway, continue.
I just can't. Nor could we. For much of the 1970s, that decline had looked irreversible. Yet Margaret Thatcher stopped the rot. She cured the economy of the disease of inflation and industrial unrest. She revived...
Look at the disdain again for workers. Industrial unrest, you know. So, yes, she did quell industrial unrest or whatever you said, Neil, but the way she did it was not by helping the workers, but by crushing their right to strike, their labor rights, their rights to better working conditions. She destroyed all of that. So, way to be misleading there, mister.
The idea of a property-owning democracy, and with her courageous and principled foreign policy.
So basically what he's implying here is nobody in Britain had the right to own property before Thatcher. That's ridiculous. What a ridiculous point. It's like he's making it seem like the Labour Party took away the right of British citizens to own property. Like they like took all of people's houses and just were like, sorry, sir, that's the property of the government. That's the property of the, ruling Labour Party now. It's like, no, they didn't do that. Like, that's not a thing. They didn't do that. Even back at this time, they did not do that. Because there, even at that time, there were a lot of people in the Labour Party that were milquetoast, mild centrists. Like later on, David Cameron was, and, you know, so these guys that were labor in name only, lino, let's call them, they were linos, and what they really did, again, was just trample all over workers' rights and help out big banks and corporations. So basically being Thatcher light, while still going by the rhetoric of helping workers. That's, you know, been the Labor Party over the last, you know, 50 years or so in a nutshell. So, except for Jeremy Corbyn, who I support a lot. I think he would have been really, really good and would have done some excellent things for Britain. But no, of course, we had to get Boris freaking Johnson instead. Anyway.
See, she restored Britain's standing in the world. Those of us who stood by her are entitled to feel proud that we were on history's winning side. But we should have no illusions about the humble, supporting roles we played. She was the leader. Proof that sometimes it really is a single individual who can change the course of history. In Margaret Thatcher's case, decidedly for the better. I'm Neil Ferguson, fellow at the Hoover Institution at Stanford for Prager University.
Oh my God. No, the only people, again, that she helped, quote unquote, for the better, was rich people. Those are the only people she helped were rich people. So, anyway, but again, Neil Ferguson is a rich person, and the organization he works for, the Hoover Institution, is a right-wing think tank dedicated to helping rich people. So, of course, he's going to say, oh, you know, she was lovely, and she helped us out, and decidedly for the better, and blah, 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 blah. It's like, yeah, because you're a rich asshole, and there's nothing Margaret Thatcher was better at than helping out rich assholes and widening the income inequality gap. So now what we're going to look at is the latest video from PragerU, and it's called What is Fair? So basically they're going to educate you on what fairness means, or what they're actually going to do in reality is strawman what the left means when they talk about fairness, when we mention fairness. So, and this is another British guy. Again, I like how PragerU does this because they have like some foreign prime ministers and some speakers from Britain and Canada and I think Denmark. He's had a couple of Danish like right-wing think tank guys and former politicians and whatever. Because they have all these foreigners, we're supposed to think that they're smart and they're honest and they're principled. But in reality, again, it's the exact opposite. Again, whatever PragerU says, 99% of the time, it's the exact opposite. It's reliably the exact opposite. So anyway, I think this guy, Daniel Hannan, he's made a couple different videos on PragerU before. So as has Neil Ferguson, I believe. So these are both PragerU veterans here. And so let's listen to Daniel Hannan talk about what is quote unquote fair.
Life isn't fair. And you know what? It can't be. Here's the problem. The word fair doesn't mean justice or equity or indeed anything very specific. Instead, it's become a sort of all-purpose statement of moral superiority.
Actually, I'm glad you brought that up, Mr. Hannan, because in a sense, you're right. The people who talk about what's fair for workers, for instance, they are morally superior to those who disparage the term fair. So, in other words, an example of fairness would be equal access. I don't want to say access to healthcare because that is usually used as a buzzword for like a kind of Obamacare type system, or, you know, like a free market based healthcare system. So I won't say access to healthcare, but equal access to quality healthcare. That's what we'll say. So that is an example right there. The people that want that, I'm sorry to disappoint you, Mr. Hannon, but the people that want that for other people are morally superior to those that don't want that for other people. Sorry, that's the truth. Let's see. People who want workers to have more rights as opposed to those people that want to destroy the rights of workers, they're morally superior to the people that oppose the better working conditions and better labor rights and protections and higher wages and things like that. Yeah, the people that support those things, they are morally superior to those that don't. Again, I'm sorry if that offends you, Mr. Hannon, or the, I don't know, two or three conservatives that listen to my podcast. I'm sorry if that offends you, but it's just the truth. I'm sorry. I don't know what to say. We are more morally superior when we mention those things in terms of what's fair. We say it is fair that if you work a full-time job, you should be able to survive. That is fair. It is fair to say, hey, everybody should have the equal opportunity to have the highest quality medical care possible without having to go into bankruptcy for it. That's morally superior. Again, sorry, but facts don't care about your feelings. Anyway, let's continue.
Superiority tinged paradoxically with victimhood. Now, fairness does have an exact meaning in certain contexts. For example, if we're playing a game, fairness means that the rules should be applied impartially. When we're kids, and our parents and teachers set the rules, the word still has that essential meaning. It's a young person's way of demanding what we might call equality before the law. But as we get older, the word becomes more of a whine. In the mouth of a teenager, trust me on this, it's not fair means, more often than not, you won't let me do something I want. In recent years, though, something odd has happened.
Okay, so let me just say something about that really quick. So that's interesting. So in Daniel Hannon's mind, what he wants the audience to think is if you strive for better working conditions, better wages, or in my mind, no wages at all, and actually owning a part of the business, I'm not talking about stocks, I'm talking about, again, worker cooperatives where everybody owns an equal part of the business. If you want that stuff, if you want high quality healthcare at a low cost, and you think that or virtually no cost, and you think that the government should be at least responsible for the funding of it, you're just a whiny teenager. Like, again, look at the contempt that this guy has for the poor and the working class. It's like, so if you just shut up and take what the capitalist system offers, you're mature and you're morally superior. But if you actually want to improve the lives of workers and not want people to go $1 million in debt because they needed chemotherapy but didn't have quality health insurance to pay for it, you're just a whiny teenager and immature, and you don't understand that, oh, life can't be fair, you know, that kind of stuff. It's like, do you know how cruel and cold that is? I can't think of another word for it. That's just cruelty to say that to someone, that if you want to try to change the world for the better in ways that you know will objectively help working people, for instance, you're a whiny teenager. Like, if you want to help people, you're the equivalent of a whiny teenager complaining to your parents. It's like, fuck you. Anyway, carry on.
Adults have started using the word
in much the same way that teenagers do.
Oh, here we go.
More than in any previous generation, people today retain their teenage sense of self-centeredness.
Oh, fuck you.
They use "it's not fair" as a catch-all complaint, as an assertion of wounded entitlement. Look at a Google graph.
Okay. So, the conservatives have had a fit over the term entitlements for a long time. And, okay, I don't think you should be entitled to every single thing on the face of the earth, but nobody on the left is saying that. But what we are saying is something called nuance. So it shouldn't be an either-or thing. If you exist on this planet, yes, you should be entitled to have, let's say you break your leg or something and you don't have adequate health insurance. You should be able to get that insurance, quality health insurance, to get the highest level of quality of care possible without going into serious debt. Like, yes, I'm sorry. You're entitled to that. Yes, you are. If you work a full-time job and you bust your ass and you do what you're supposed to do, which is, by the way, the vast majority of people. Yes, I know. Conservatives, I know there are some lazy people. Okay, fine. But for the vast majority of people that actually do bust their ass and work hard, they deserve to keep the lights on. They deserve to keep themselves fed or their kids fed or their partners or spouses fed. You know, they deserve to have enough money to put gas in the car. They deserve, they are entitled to that. So it's not an either or thing. Like the same thing with the, like, a quality of outcome thing that Jordan Peterson and people like that talk about all the time. Like, ooh, the left wants equality of outcome. It's like, not really. In some cases, yes, but in other cases, no. So let me explain. Again, healthcare, perfect example. So we want everybody to get the same quality of care regardless of ability to pay. But at the same time, I have no problem, which we're going to get to after I'm done with the double video breakdown. We are also saying, at least me being a market socialist, which again, we'll get into later, what we're saying is past that, you know, the healthcare and shelter and water and food and things like that, all these natural resources and a reasonable stipend, if you will, of clothing. After that, then, okay, I'm fine with a market system. There's nothing that I see that's inherently wrong with that, which is the subject of today's podcast. So it's not like an either-or thing. It's like nobody, even like the most diehard Marxist on the planet, nobody is arguing that everybody should have like three Lamborghinis. Nobody ever said that. Marx never said it. Even Lenin never said that, you know? I mean, Lenin, he just wanted the spoils for himself. Like, that's what he wanted. So, but the point is, nobody has ever advocated for equality of outcome in every way, shape, and form ever on everything. Like, nobody believes that. Nobody believes that. So, that's just, again, that's straw manning. He knows that that's not true. But again, he says it anyway because it benefits him financially to spew this propaganda. So,
of the use of the word fairness. From around 1965, it looks like the proverbial hockey stick. Flat, and then it suddenly shoots up.
Who cares? That's irrelevant. This is a complete non sequitur. This has nothing to do with, like, ooh, people are using the word fairness more often. So what? Like, I don't understand the point he's trying. Well, I actually do. He's trying to say, ooh, look at the the frequency of the word of the use of the word fairness has increased. So you know, this is a bad thing, and this is blah 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 blah. It's like, I don't give a shit if the frequency of the word fairness has increased. I really don't care. I mean, my toe jam means more to me than that. I care more about my toe jam than I care about the frequency of the use of the word fairness. Total non sequitur, totally missing the point of the term fairness, and totally just avoiding the task at hand here that you're trying to that you're trying to perform here. So,
developed a fairness obsession. But what do we mean when we use the word? Do we mean justice? Do we mean equality? Do we mean need? Or do we mean something else?
Aha! So, do you see what he's doing there? He's acting like the very postmodernist that the right claims to hate in the left. Like, they claim that, you know, all these leftists are, you know, in Jordan Peterson, again, in his words, postmodern neo-Marxists. It's like, dude, you have no idea. You read like the first couple of pages of the Communist Manifesto, and you think that makes you an expert on Marxism. Please. Oh my God. It's like, I'm not a Marxist, but I know way more about basic Marxist theory than Jordan freaking Peterson or Daniel freaking Hannon, you know? So, anyway, let's look up the definition of the word fair, shall we? Or fairness. Let's do that. There is an objective definition of the word fairness: impartial and just treatment or behavior without favoritism or discrimination. That is the definition of fairness. And the other ones they give are for like beauty, like fair, fair complexion. It is for like white people, essentially. And then there's the fair is in like beautiful. But as far as what he's trying to say, he's just making up definitions. The dictionary definition is impartial and just treatment or behavior without favoritism or discrimination. That's all that means. So, again, healthcare, perfect example. In the case of healthcare, fairness means people should have the same treatment impartially and without discrimination, regardless of their ability to pay. So you cannot be discriminated against based on your ability to pay in order to get the highest quality medical care. So that's what we mean in that instance, and in pretty much every other instance. So again, he's just throwing around random definitions. Again, acting like the very postmodernist he would probably claim to oppose. So anyway, let's carry on.
Suppose you and Jane buy a cake together. You pay $6 and Jane pays $4. What would be the fair way to split it up? You could do it on the basis of proportionality. In other words, you get 60% of the cake and Jane gets 40%. Or you could do it on the basis of strict egalitarianism, half each, regardless of who paid what. Or you could do it on the basis of wealth. Jane has much less money than you for non-essentials like cake, so maybe she should get the larger share. A case can be made for each approach. But the beauty of the word fair is that it doesn't require you to come down clearly in favor of any of them. It gives you...
Okay. Okay, so the cake example. I would say what fairness would be is... Now, he's giving the example of buying a cake, but let me give you an example of if you make a cake. Okay, so let's say He said that you, as in the person watching this video, and Jane, are buying a cake. Again, I'll make it making a cake. We're baking it. So Jane and I are baking a cake. Okay? We put an equal amount of work into we agree to divide the work 50-50, roughly. So we should each get half of the cake. That, in my opinion, sounds fair to me. As far as his example, I think what would be quote-unquote fair in that particular instance is basically, since he paid $6 and she paid $4, I don't necessarily think, because you don't know the situation, I think since there's two of them, they should divide it equally. So basically, despite the fact that he paid more for it, I think they both should have half of the cake. So that's the example that I agree with that he gave. But again, he's just throwing out these random examples to make a straw man of egalitarianism. And he's making it seem like politicians, this is funny. They really honestly don't care about this stuff. I hate to break it to you, Daniel Hannon, but politicians don't give a shit about egalitarianism. But what egalitarianism really means, or what egalitarianism is really about, is, again, equal access to resources. So everybody has an equal right to access natural resources such as water or trees, food. You know, like this is what we're talking about in regard to egalitarianism. Again, nobody's saying like I'll use an example that he would probably use. So let's say you have, I don't know, 10 baseballs, okay? So in Daniel Hannon's mind, if there's two people fighting over baseballs and there's 10 baseballs, what he's saying is that lefties would say, if you basically they both should get 5, you know, and that would be an example of egalitarianism, kind of like, again, it's like a straw man. Or let's use a more, let's use this one. That honestly was not very good. So let's use this one. Let's say you're a person who has no cars and you see that your next door neighbor has 2 cars. In Daniel Hannon's mind, what the left wants to do in that instance is make it so so they take away, like, the government, like, knocks on your door and takes away the next door, or knocks on their door, sorry, and takes away one of their cars and gives it to me, so that I have a car. And so basically, the two people in this fictional neighborhood, they each have one car. Like, that's like the straw man of egalitarianism. Like, ooh, so if somebody has 2 cars and you don't have a car, you would want a policy that says you have to get one car and you get to forcibly take your neighbor's second car, and the government can give it to you. It's like, first of all, I'm an anarchist, so I don't believe in using the government to do much of anything. And number two, that's not what we mean when we say egalitarianism. Or at least it's not what I'm saying. Again, I'm a market socialist, which, again, we'll get into in a minute. But I do believe in egalitarianism when it comes to access to resources. Again, food, water, shelter, medicine, healthcare. Again, a baseline of clothing, all this stuff, and utilities as well. I think utilities should not be charged. It's like, I don't think you should be charged for heating your house or cooling it or whatever. So that's what we mean when we're talking about egalitarianism and quote-unquote fairness.
View the cover of ambiguity. So, for example, when a politician says, we want the rich to pay their fair share, he doesn't usually mean that he wants the rich to pay taxes at the same rate as everyone else. He means that he wants them to pay extra. The word...
Aha! So that's what this is about. And I've seen this video before, so I'm being a little bit facetious, because I knew this was coming. But now you see what this is about. The whole conversation, he revealed his whole purpose, I mean, in doing this video, in that little segment here. This is all about, surprise, surprise, because it's PragerU, defending the rich. This is what it's about. Like, so he's, usually when PragerU says the word politicians, they're usually referring to the nominally quote-unquote left parties, like the Democrats and the Labour Party and blah, 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 blah. You know, the Liberal Party in Canada. So that's what they mean when they say politicians. They're not calling out their own politicians, because PragerU never calls out their own politicians. So anyway, with this, this again is a total straw man. This is so funny, because he mentioned entitlement brings about victimhood or something like that. But it's interesting. Just a couple minutes later, you seem to portray the rich as victims. Like, the rich, my God, man, they have this, again, they do. They have this victim complex. Like, oh, we're so persecuted. Oh, yes, it must be so hard having 6 yachts and 3 houses and, you know, 20 cars and, you know, 10 TVs and a private movie theater and a private bowling alley. And in Mitt Romney's case, a car elevator. You know, it must be so hard dealing with that. So in this case, Hannon is actually right. That in terms of fair share, it is slightly different. So he is right that we do want the rich to pay a higher portion than the middle class and the workers, but what he's missing is, because, you know, again, it's in his interest to leave this out, the rich on paper pay a higher tax rate than the working class and the poor, okay? But in reality, nobody pays that rate. That's just the nominal rate. Nobody pays even close to that rate, because there's all these deductions and loopholes that rich people, and especially the corporations they own, can weasel out of paying. So they can exploit these loopholes to avoid paying their quote-unquote fair share of taxes. So this is, again, a classic PragerU strategy where they just are so brazen and obvious about where they stand. They're like, let's do a flat tax. Like, that's basically what he's talking about there. Like, if we really wanted to make it fair, we would do a flat tax. Now, when I was an ANCAP, or at least close to an ANCAP, I was never really an ANCAP. I've said that in the past that I was, but I was really, to steal a phrase from Dave Rubin, I was really more of a classical liberal, because I never believed in the viability or the efficacy of a 100% laissez-faire capitalist system, but I was definitely like 80 to 90% laissez-faire at the time when I was into that philosophy. So anyway, the point is, taking, let's say 10%. So taking 10% of, let's say, $1,000, taking 10% of $1,000 is going to hurt a rich person way less than 10% on $100 for a working class person. So again, if you are, this is why a flat tax is not fair, because the impact is way different. So if you're rich and you make that $1,000, you get to keep 900 of those $1,000. So it's not going to hurt you as much as somebody who only has $100, but yet is still obligated to pay 10% of their income to the government, only leaving them with $90 as opposed to the $900. Do you see what I mean here? So this is why flat taxes are unfair. But again, he is trying to make the case for the flat tax. Like, hey, can't we just have a flat tax? Why do the rich have to pay so much more than the working class? Because then the working class would be paying more money than they even have, because the rich have almost all of the money. So, unbelievable. And it's, again, thanks to people like Thatcher and Reagan, they have all this money now, and it's continued under people like both Bushes and somewhat under Obama, although he was like marginally, almost negligibly better on this issue. But Trump has just taken it to a whole new level of, you know, of inequality and just ridiculousness. So anyway, the only thing the rich don't like about Donald Trump is his mean tweets, let's be honest. So anyway, continue.
Fair lets him present higher rates of taxation as a form of justice.
Because it is.
But only if we don't think about it too hard.
Oh, here we go.
That's the beauty of it. Fair doesn't ultimately mean proportionate or impartial or equal. You can use it to mean almost any positive thing you like.
Wrong.
I want fairness generally means, look at me, I'm a nice person.
Yes.
Demanding fairness lets you tell the world how decent you are without your actually having to contribute a penny.
Again, look at the disdain he has for poor people and the working class. So if you're struggling to make ends meet and you're struggling to, you know, pay your taxes, and in the case of poor people, you actually don't you actually can't pay taxes, and you get like earned income tax credits and things like that. But if you do that, assholes like Daniel Hannan come around and they say, well, hey, man, you don't actually contribute anything to society, so you don't deserve to survive, essentially, in society. And once again, the rich are so persecuted because they contribute so much to society. And you know, look at these moochers, these peasants, these parasites, they contribute nothing. It's like, dude, do you know who built, here's a good question for Daniel Hannan. Who built the yachts, the cars, the houses, you know, that your rich buddies own? Who built those? It wasn't the rich people. It was the workers who worked in, those industries that built those goods for those rich people. Again, the house builders, the roofers, the auto manufacturers, the yacht builders, you know, they're the ones that did that. So they are contributing. So that's a totally bullshit, totally, honestly, classist argument. Like, ooh, you didn't contribute anything. It's like, again, so to guys like this, your worth as a human being and the measure of how much you contribute to society is determined by how much wealth you've created in your life. So let's use an example here. Okay. So again, you're at an auto manufacturer and you can barely make ends meet and you're on Medicaid because the company that you work for doesn't pay enough for you to be able to afford health insurance, so you're on Medicaid. So Daniel Hannan would call you a moocher and a loser and a parasite, and you know, oh, you should just work harder. But he, I guarantee you, he gives people like Mitt Romney a pass when all Mitt Romney does all day is sit on his ass and manipulate the stock market and basically let his money make money for him. So a guy that literally has done nothing for anyone his entire life, he is super rich, and Daniel Hannan has nothing to say about that. But a person who busts his ass working at least 12-hour days on an assembly line building cars, you know, oh, this guy, he needs to work harder. That's why he's not making it. He just needs to work harder. And, you know, he's just a lazy piece of shit. And he just needs to suck it up and get over it. It's like, fuck you.
It's a kind of vanity. Mirror, mirror on the wall. Who's the fairest of them all?
Nice pun, big guy.
Let's get real. The only way to distribute the cake is to see how much people are prepared to pay for their slice.
Wrong.
Sure, that could leave a banker with a bigger slice than a baker. Sure, we might not like that distribution. We might feel that the baker is doing something more valuable than the banker. He's making delicious pastries while the money man doesn't seem to be making anything except money for himself.
Exactly.
But how can we judge someone else's economic worth? You might want bakers to be paid more than bankers. I might want teachers to be paid more than movie stars. Since we all have our own preferences, the only way to measure the economic value of a service is to see how much others are prepared to pay for it.
That's bullshit.
That's what the market does. It aggregates our preferences. It doesn't ask us in the abstract what we think someone else deserves.
It aggregates our preferences. Oh, this is... Okay. In a good market system, it would. So that's partially correct. But in the capitalist sense, it doesn't do that. Because what if your preference is to get, again, higher quality healthcare at a cheaper cost? Most Americans cannot say that that happens for them. So they prefer having a lower cost for medical services, but they're not getting it because of the insurance companies buying off the government and ripping off their customers. So this is total bullshit.
It tests in reality how many hours of our own labor we're prepared to put in exchange for a product or a service.
False.
Under every other economic system, our relations are mediated by accidents of birth and social caste, and financial rewards are determined by favoritism.
What?
The free market alone.
You just made that up. You just made that up. Like, that's not... That's... What? That's literally what capitalism does. Like, you just made that up. Like, oh, you know, these other economic systems throughout history have... It's like... okay. So, is he right about that? Yes, but to paint it, this is what I mean. To paint capitalism as if it's not subject to those things is utterly false. So he's just making up that capitalism is immune to those things. That's what I meant to say. But it's victim to all of what he just said, so...
Gives everyone the same rights. My money is as good as yours. You can't get fairer than that. I'm Daniel Hannan, president of the Initiative for Free Trade and author of Inventing Freedom for Prager University.
So again, so obviously that's not true. Again, if you want to get adequate health care, I'm sure this guy can afford it. So his money is good in that respect. But if you are a guy who I'm sure works 10 times harder than this guy, like again, my example of the yacht builder, the ship builder, if you're that guy or the auto worker, if you're that guy, you most likely cannot afford quality health insurance. So at least in America, maybe abroad, in certain cases, it's a little bit of a different story. But specifically in America, it's very unlikely that you actually have adequate health coverage and medical care. So absolute nonsense. But anyway, let's get to the heart of the podcast here today. I guess you can't really call it the heart because we're an hour and 16 minutes into this, but the thing that I wanted, the thing that ties this all together is there is such a thing as market socialism. And that's what I mostly adhere to. Once again, I want people to have equal access to and just an equal share of, again, healthcare, quality healthcare, food, water, shelter, medicine, all this stuff, clothing, like I said, or at least a baseline of clothing. So that stuff, I'm fine with it being relatively egalitarian. But on the other hand, I do support for what are typically classified as luxury goods or consumer goods being subject to a market system. Sorry about that. So if we're talking about iPhones, let's just say smartphones. Yeah, let's just say smartphones. I'm perfectly fine with that being part of a market system because I'm not necessarily sure if it's a realistic solution. Because this is what, like, pure ANCOMs believe in. They believe that all goods should be in, like, this common storehouse, I think it's called. And you just take what you need from that. I don't really see that as a realistic thing. I think that the market can allocate certain goods more efficiently and more effectively than others. So, again, the markets should not be conflated with capitalism. You know, capitalism is not like inherently the market system. Just like the subject of this podcast is that markets are not inherently bad. Again, putting things to the market like healthcare and education and water and food and medicine and shelter and all that stuff, that is terrible, and I don't think that we should be commodifying those things. But if you're talking about things like smartphones or, let's say, musical instruments, something like, because I told you guys I'm a music guy. So if you're talking about that stuff, I'm perfectly fine with that being part of a market system. But we have to figure out a way to get away from like fiat currency and things like that. I'm not necessarily sure what would be a good replacement for that, but if we could find a way to have a market system for luxury and consumer goods while decommodifying things like land, shelter, medical, medicine, healthcare, you know, food, water, shelter, blah, 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 blah. If we could decommodify that stuff and then leave the rest of the stuff to a market-based system, then I'd be fine with that. So I actually do support a mixed economy, not a pure economy, because I don't think an economy, like a pure economy, is good in any instance. I think you do need a mix because life is nuanced, and I just don't agree with mixing social democratic welfare policies and largely quote-unquote free market capitalist policies. I don't think that that's a good mix, because it's shown that it's a terrible mix, because it doesn't really give people adequate access to the essential resources they need to survive. The market doesn't do that, and the public sector doesn't really do that, to be honest, at least not as well as it could be under a socialized system, an anarchist system, where, again, things like healthcare and shelter and food are held in common, but you can purchase things like furniture or phones or musical instruments, like I said, or video games or something like that, from some sort of a market system. So I think that that's a pretty fair position to take. So again, this is why markets are not inherently bad. It's just that I don't necessarily think the capitalist market system is very effective, because it sets up a lot of perverse incentive structures. Like, for instance, if you have quote-unquote defense contractors, you have a fiduciary incentive to want constant war. If you are in the fossil fuel industry, you have a fiduciary incentive to keep producing all this oil and gas and polluting the atmosphere. So it creates a lot of perverse incentive structures. The reality is nothing is all bad or all good. So I'm not saying a market socialist system would be all good, and I'm not saying that the capitalist system is all bad, but there are a lot of bad things about the capitalist system that I think can be ameliorated with a market socialist system. That's the point I'm trying to make. So, and of course, the other thing that capitalism doesn't incentivize is workplace democracy. It's not generally a system that's conducive to workplace democracy, because if it's deemed that workplace democracy and distributing the fruits of labor evenly, if that's deemed to be unprofitable, you're going to do everything in your power to make sure that you get rid of anything that is going to prevent you from padding your bottom line. So again, that's not a very good incentive structure for workplace democracy, which is my goal. So now, of course, the one exception to this, and there are a couple of exceptions, but the most notable one being Mondragon. Mondragon is relatively democratic. They elected their CEO, and you know that, and it's a very successful corporation. I think Wikipedia said it's like the seventh largest corporation in all of Spain, something like that. So it is very successful, but as a general rule, I don't think the capitalist system, again, is very conducive to widespread workplace democracy. So, again, I'm fine with a market system along as long as workplace democracy is preserved and implemented and preserved. Sorry, and then as long as people have an equal access to resources that are essential for human survival. So, again, I'm not necessarily sure what we would use as a currency. I definitely oppose fiat currency, which is imposed by the state. And as a person that's opposed to the state, I obviously oppose that. So, I'm not necessarily sure what we could use as currency, but I'm sure we could figure something out and come up with some medium of exchange that is, number one, convenient to carry, and number two, not very complicated to exchange for goods and services. So anyway, that's my take on market socialism. I'll go further in a future podcast, but this is just the basics of my feelings on market socialism and kind of like an intro 100 level college course, crash course on market socialism. So anyway, I hope you guys enjoyed this podcast, and I will try to talk to you guys again next week. And thank you for tuning in once again to The Left Side of Liberty. Oh, and one thing before I go. If you like my podcast and would like to help support it, please consider donating to my Patreon page. It is patreon.com/theleftsideofliberty. That's patreon.com/theleftsideofliberty. I need your support. Please become a patron today. Thank you very much, guys. I appreciate it.